Hello and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions based on what you've left for me in the comments section below of my Q&A videos, as well as emailing to me at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. You know, I've started that new podcast I referred to last week, and the second episode of that podcast is out now. And I decided that I would add it to my YouTube channel rather than set up an additional or different YouTube channel for the podcast. That's now available on this channel as well. So if you're subscribed here, you'll be getting notices about that. You can also subscribe at sensiblyspeaking.com or on iTunes. The podcast is now available on iTunes as well. And, you know, I'm talking about it because I'm proud of our podcast, the one that Ruth and I are doing, and I want you all to listen to that as well as watch my videos. This week, we are going to go rapid fire through a bunch of questions I've selected that I can give pretty good, fast answers to. Some of these have been hanging fire for weeks or even a couple months, and I'm sorry about that. I get so many questions, and I go through and try to get the ones to answer, and some of these have been wanting to answer for a while, so this show, we're just going to bang right through a bunch of them and see how this goes. Here we go. Howard Gabriel, do you think L. Ron Hubbard made staff contracts 2.5 or 5-year contracts to trap members or suppress them and unknowingly stop them from doing and getting up the bridge? No, I don't think that the 2.5 and 5-year contracts were set up on some kind of evil purpose on the part of L. Ron Hubbard in order to prevent people from getting up the bridge. In fact, I think just the opposite is true, because my own personal experience as a staff member was I did go up the bridge to clear when I was a staff member in Santa Barbara Org. It wasn't until I joined the C organization that I made no progress in Scientology as far as movement on that bridge goes. And I think things in the C Org are set up that way so that people don't move up the bridge without a great deal of effort, because you know, the Sea Org is a slave system. Staff is, you know, not a great system either, but at least you have the potential or the possibility of moving up the bridge as a staff member, whereas it's much harder in the Sea Org. Mr. Marathon 1989, are you familiar with Amway network marketing type companies? And if so, do you think that their tactics are similar to those used in cults? I am familiar with Amway and those multi-level marketing campaign type companies. My parents actually got involved with Amway for a little while when I was a kid. No, nothing huge, but that's how I'm familiar with it. Steve Hassan actually talks about these kind of organizations in his book, Combating Cult Mind Control, and these are definitely have the potential for being cult-like activities, using cult control methods on their members. And from what I've seen and heard and experienced of these, yes, they are very much like a destructive cult with a cult leader or, you know, a small group of people at the top of a pyramid type setup where all the money is up at the top. And then you have a bunch of worker bees and people down below who are working their guts out trying to achieve this, you know, wonderful state that the leaders are at, but they're never going to get there because the leaders have it set up that they're the only ones who are getting all the money, and all the people below them are the ones who are doing all the work, which is definitely a situation I'm familiar with. So, yes, I think that they fit the model just as well as things like Scientology do. Renewed Calm. If the Sea Org members generally don't get anywhere up the bridge, how do they feel about the fairness of that? Do they have the attitude that, oh well, it sucks not to be rich enough to buy the superhuman powers, but at least I'm working 24/7 to provide the structure to help others buy theirs? This all particularly confuses me since you say in the next Q&A that participation in Scientology is a pretty narcissistic activity. Okay, well, here's the thing about being in the Sea Org that is a bit different than the narcissistic kind of attitude that we talk about with Scientologists in terms of the Scientology public. In the Sea Org, these people have decided to put their entire lives on hold, or just put their entire lives aside, and go 24/7 to do nothing but forward Scientology's purpose. That's a fairly selfless thing to do, and people in the Sea Org see themselves more in a martyr-type case than they do in
adopting that sort of narcissism that we talk about with the public of Scientology, who are so status happy and all that. Certainly, a lot of the narcissism and the status symbol nonsense carries over into the Sea Org in its own way. And there's a caste system within the Sea Organization, and there's, you know, various classes and levels and whatnot that sort of permeate throughout the Sea Organization. You know, like, for example, RTC are practically worshipped as gods, whereas people at the lower levels in the service organizations are just the, you know, petty little minions, and are not really, don't really have much status at all in the hierarchy. So you have that kind of thing going on in the Sea Organization, but you have a bunch of people there who are, like when I was there, for example, I worked 17 years in the Sea Organization with no real hope of getting up the bridge. I certainly wanted to, but no study time afforded to me, no auditing, no auditors. So it was always a struggle. And you wouldn't think, having a bunch of people who are doing nothing but Scientology, that they would have a problem with allocating some time to going up the bridge. Unfortunately, that's not really the case. Study time is one of the first things to go in the case of an emergency or a perceived emergency, which happened all the time. And so, for example, an event is coming up, one of those international events, and everybody is off study doing call-in to call the public and get them to attend the event, or going out door to door and knocking on doors in order to give people tickets to get them to go to the events. Things like that are considered emergencies in the Sea Organization, and everybody puts everything on hold in order to work on just that. So anyway, that kind of stuff builds up over time, and then years have gone by and you haven't made any progress whatsoever. And that's kind of how things go in the Sea Organization. So that's more the spirit and idea of what happens in there.
Anon 8109. In one of your videos, you said, "You can't have a knowingness." Was that intentional use of Hubbard speak? If not, then why is it difficult for ex-homo novus to extricate themselves from Hubbard's lingo? Why do mind control phrases such as "you pulled it in" seem so natural and appealing despite being such obvious nonsense?
When I said that line in that video some weeks ago, I think it was actually a couple months ago, about how I can't have a knowingness, or you can't have a knowingness, that was a slip of the tongue for sure. That was some Hubbard speaks, slipping out of my mouth. And that, of course, is because I have been in a recovery process from this cult. And it's, 27 years of indoctrination is a lot of time. And the language of destructive cults is something that is instilled into their members very much on purpose. I've mentioned before that this is something that when you're recovering from a cult or a destructive situation like that, you have to work proactively to flush that out of your system. And I know of people who have been out of Scientology for many, many years, especially those who call themselves independent Scientologists or are still practicing Scientology outside of the church. They don't ever let go of the language, and as a result, they don't ever get out of the thought patterns of the cult, because that's what keeps those thought patterns in place, is the language. You are set to think about things in a certain way. For example, you have the reactive mind, and or the bank, or the engrams. And if you keep using those words and referring and looking at the world through the filter of those concepts, and still thinking that way, then you're not really getting out of the cult thought process and the patterns of that, and it inhibits a person's recovery from being able to get back into the real world, which is why I so heavily encourage not using the language when you get out. And it takes work, especially for people like me who had been in for decades. So that's why the slip.
Bodies in Pawn. Do you know whatever happened to Stephen Fishman? Could you talk about his case? I find it quite fascinating. Thanks.
I've been asked a few times from a few different people about Steve Fishman, and to be honest with you, I never heard of Steve Fishman. I mean, I heard of Steve Fishman, but I'd never looked up anything on him or looked up any of his videos or checked him out at all. And it wasn't until this last week, in fact, that Tony Ortega posted an article explaining everything about Steve Fishman and the fact that he was never really a Scientologist, and in fact was just a con man who was using Scientology lingo and whatnot in order to try to get out of legal trouble. Fascinating article, and I've put the link to Tony's article in the notes section of this video, so you can check that out, because he's giving a much better explanation and idea of who Steve Fishman is and what he was all about than I ever could.
Oso Buko, I have an important question. Do you have any idea how chromatically disturbing is your squared gray shirts above your green t-shirt?
Hey, I didn't realize that I had fashion police patrolling my channel. This is awesome. I did not know that it was so chromatically horrifying, some of my wardrobe choices, but I've taken that into account and I don't intend to repeat that mistake ever again.
Whale Boy. Hello, Mr. Shelton. I was wondering what key piece or pieces of data do you think would be most damning to a typical Scientologist's mental resolve and cause them to doubt? I understand that your disillusionment with Scientology took months to build up, but what fact, had you heard it in the depth of your brainwashing, would have shaken your faith the greatest?
This is another question that people have asked me in various ways over the last few months. And it's a near impossible question to answer, which is why I've sort of dragged my heels in getting around to it. I've put a lot of thought into it, in fact. What is it that you could say to a Scientologist that would get him questioning? And, you know, with the study that I've done on the subject, it's become very clear to me what I already had the idea of, which is there isn't any magic words or magic concept or thing, you know, one size fits all sort of thing you can communicate to all Scientologists that is going to get them to snap out of it or wake up or not believe so hard in what they're doing. There are things you can say to Scientologists, but here's the thing. It's an individual thing. Each person in Scientology is there for their own reasons. And therefore, what they think is important about Scientology is different from person to person. And for example, so you know, you can see what I'm talking about. I met OTs in Scientology who didn't care at all about the whole track or past lives or even the whole, you know, OT3 Xenu thing. Now, of course, I didn't talk to them about Xenu, but what I mean by that is they didn't care about the wonder and amazement of body thetans and spaceships and galactic civilizations and all that. It didn't mean anything to them because they were in Scientology in order to have a, you know, basically calmer, happier existence. And if this is how they had to go about doing it, then that's what they were going to do. Whereas I've also met other people in Scientology who couldn't get enough of all of that whole track space opera, spaceship, and galactic civilization stuff, and they wouldn't shut up about it. And they went on and on and on about that, and that was their go button for being in Scientology, is all of that hoopaloo about you know, how we've lived on earlier on other planets, and there's spaceships out there, and they come around to Earth and check us out, and they know about Scientology. Oh, there's all kinds of crazy conspiracy theories in Scientology about this kind of stuff. So, point being, each individual Scientologist you have to talk to individually. You have to find out what their go buttons are, what their reasons are for being involved in the first place, and then address those. And every Scientologist will have a chink in their armor, a thing that they have doubts or reservations about, especially now. I mean, after, you know, all this time with all this stuff out there on the interwebs and all that, you know, it's not that Scientologists don't know anything about this stuff, and it's not that they don't see abuses in the organization with the over-regging and everything else. So if you can, the thing that that is required in order to produce those chinks in the armor and get through to those people is truly caring about them, real compassion for their situation, and getting across to them in a way that they will listen to. And that means that you got to be, you know, honest, open, and caring with them. Real love, you know, is what's going to get through in the case of family members and whatnot. So that's what it takes. And with that bridge in place, that bridge of caring, I guess you could say, you then have somebody who's willing to listen to you, and then you can get through to them. So that's my answer.
Matthew Theron. Many ex-Scientologists, Jason Begay, Paul Haggis, yourself, to name a few, start out by acknowledging that they gained from the communications course they took. Which communication course did you take specifically? Many thanks.
So the very first course that I ever did in Scientology when I was 15 years old, not counting the courses I did when I was a very young kid and I had no idea what I was doing, the first one that I did that I did know what I was doing and I knew it was Scientology and I wanted to do it, was the Professional TRs course, which is going to shock a lot of people who've been in Scientology because that's not a course people do as their very first course, pretty much ever. I was pretty unique that way. I did that course because I bought a package of courses, and that was the course that dealt with communication. And I got into Scientology to handle communication, as I've talked about. And so I went for the Big Daddy. I went for that Professional TRs course. And that's the course where you sit and do those TRs, those drills, for hours and hours and hours. I did TR Zero, which is the one where you sit in a chair and you just look at somebody and they're looking right back at you. And you have to do that for 2 straight hours. No move, no fidget, no nothing before you'll pass that drill. And of course, it takes hours and hours and hours before you can get to a solid 2 straight hours of doing that. So again, that's why it's not very usual that that be the first course that people do. You know, I read Keeping Scientology Working, that policy letter, first thing I ever read on that course. So, you know, I kind of jumped, you know, pretty high, pretty fast in doing that course. And it was just because that's the package of courses that I bought. Most people go in and they do that Success Through Communications course as their first course, or then there's an intermediate course called the TRs and Objectives course, or another Therapeutic TRs course was another course that was available for a while. I don't think it is anymore, where you do a sort of a lesser toughness of those communication drills. So that's how I did it.
La Striada. Have you ever thought that there are striking parallels between the Church of Scientology and the Jehovah's Witnesses? Both were founded by money-grubbing con men, LRH and Judge Rutherford, practice disconnection, disfellowshipping, and are obviously highly authoritarian.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I did see parallels between Jehovah's Witnesses and Scientology, which is why I did an interview on an ex-Jehovah's Witness activist, Lloyd Evans, a couple weeks ago, and we'll be doing more interviews with other ex-cult members from other groups as well. Because I see parallels in all kinds of destructive groups or cults and with Scientology. So check it out.
Charles A. Prince. Chris, thank you for your incredible videos and shedding a light on this cult religion. My question is this. I have seen on Karen's channel a video about the disarray, the decaying state of Big Blue. Broken restrooms, no fire alarms, broken elevators, broken lights, and working in and around with asbestos. Is this a violation of city codes and work environment in the city of Los Angeles? Could the city come in and close Big Blue until the building is updated to specifications? Has anyone attempted to do so, or is this against the First Amendment rights?
So first off, Big Blue is the complex of buildings that are all painted blue in Los Angeles and Hollywood, and that's where I worked for 17 years. It's also called the Pacific Base, or the Pacifica Base, and it's also called Big Blue. So as far as code violations and fire regulations and asbestos and all that, I don't know anything about the asbestos in that building. I never heard about that. But I lived in that building, that Big Blue building with the Scientology across the top of it, for 17 years. And during the course of living there, you find out some things, like the fact that the Church of Scientology has a bit of an in with the fire department and with the city. To the point that they know when an inspector is coming around. Very, very rarely is the city going to pull a surprise inspection on the Church of Scientology. So they know what's coming, they know who's coming, they know when they're coming, and they prep for it. And they lock doors that they don't want those people going into, and they clean up the hallways, and they make sure there's no fire code violations. And they do that in preparation for those people coming. And when those people aren't coming, they don't really do a lot of enforcement on that sort of thing. Maybe some. Maybe there's one or two people who kind of care a bit. But for the most part, that's when, all the sort of slack nonsense goes on. And, the other thing is, of course, that the Church of Scientology doesn't care at all about what OSHA has to say or any other city regulations. All of those things are just a bother to the Church of Scientology in its course, you know, and its mission to get on with clearing the planet. They could give a rat's whatever about the laws of the land or what anybody has to say about what they're doing or their operations. So that's sort of the attitude that those things are met with. But when those people are around, of course, it's all smiles and handshakes and salutes and thank you very much, sir, for coming around and helping us out with this and all that sort of thing. But they really do operate at a bare minimum level of compliance with those regulations. At least when I was there, they did, because they don't care about those things. Also, one thing I should note is that none of that has to do with First Amendment issues. OSHA doesn't care at all whether you're a religion or not, and neither does the fire marshal, because what they're regulating has nothing to do with religious beliefs. So no, it has nothing, anything to do with the First Amendment.
David Bean. Hi, Chris. Thanks for all you're doing. A niche question, but I've been wondering. Since you mentioned you never made it to the OT levels while you were in the Sea Org, and since we all know their content are secret, what did you imagine would be in them and they teach you if you got there?
Yeah, so my idea of what was in the OT levels was pretty far out. You know, when you get to the state of clear in Scientology, which is just before the OT levels, you're considered clear on the first dynamic. Now, I'm not going to get into all the dynamics again. I did that last week. But the first dynamic is just yourself. And so you're only clear personally. So I imagined that the OT levels, what they say in this Scientology is that the OT levels address the rest of the dynamics and clear you on the rest of the dynamics, on the rest of life. So I imagined when I was in Scientology that those OT levels were somehow, when those guys were going in session, they were somehow telepathically or through their OT powers affecting things going on out in the world. And of course, that sort of, you know, nonsense thought process of mine would be reinforced or, you know, by OTs and by, you know, things you would hear or see or whatever, you know. So that you'd sort of reinforce that kind of belief. Now, this was just me. This is just one of the ideas that I thought. But I talked about this with other Scientologists, and they sort of nodded sagely and this sort of thing. Because, of course, none of the OTs were going to tell me anything about body thetans or the fact that they were ridding their body of body thetans. That I had no idea about that. None. I didn't even suspect it, had never heard the term, didn't know anything. So my imagination went in the direction of OT powers, you know, to affect the world in a more positive light, or a more positive direct way. And that was actually one of the reasons why when I did find out what was on the OT levels, I was like, this makes no sense whatsoever, because it doesn't. And, you know, and I kind of had the idea that out on other worlds where life must exist, you know, just mathematically, if for no other reason, you know, that they didn't have Scientology, and so they were out there suffering, and we had to bring it to them, because this was the only place in the entire universe, planet Earth, where Scientology existed. And so there's this idea in Scientology of Target 2, where we're going to go off and clear other planets, and I actually thought that once we got planet Earth handled, we were going to get in spaceships, and we were going to fly off to these other worlds, and we were going to bring Scientology to them, and that's you know, a little bit ridiculous, but that was kind of my concept of it. And so that's how I thought we were going to salvage this sector of the universe.
Barbara Miller, when you're going to the RPF, like the minute they say come with us, do you know where you're going and why? Also, when you get there, I mean, my first instinct would be to run no matter what I did. Do you really believe you deserve it? I can't remember. Were you in the RPF?
Nobody in the Sea Org is going to go running away when they come get them for the RPF, and it's not really exactly how it works. You know it's coming. You know, there's no illusions. Nobody's grabbing you and dragging you down hallways in handcuffs to take you down to the RPF. It doesn't work that way. There's definitely you know, the idea that you're going there. You know it's coming. And you set yourself up for it, and you have to sign papers when you arrive there that you agree to do it. And if you don't agree to do the program, you don't do it. Now, there were cases I saw in the church that people were given the choice of being declared a suppressive person or doing the RPF, which is not really much of any choice at all. But, you know, almost one for one, I saw those people not graduate the RPF. They got on the RPF, started doing the RPF, and then after a few months, gave up and, you know, routed out, took off. And they weren't in Scientology anymore, or they were, you know, maybe they got declared, maybe they didn't. But, you know, kind of a case-by-case basis on that. There's no blanket anything on that kind of stuff. Justice is a whim. It's a toss of the dice in Scientology as to what's going to happen to you. Also, the other thing I want to say about that is that everybody on the RPF does believe that they deserve to be there. And if somebody did come into the RPF who had an attitude or had this idea that they shouldn't be there and that sort of thing, they get slapped into place pretty fast by the rest of the group. You know, and there's nobody in the RPF who's like doing some kind of holier than thou thing or I shouldn't be here, because they just get the boot. You know, that kind of person doesn't last very long in the Sea Org. And yes, I did do the RPF, and it took me 3 years and 3 months to do it.
Tony Nelson, what is your take on the Antichrist version of OT8? If it was real, it seems like it was changed by Scientology quickly, or is it fake like Scientology has said? I was curious if you had any definitive knowledge on this topic.
When I went to the Toronto Going Clear conference and met Jesse Prince, he actually had a copy of that bulletin from Hubbard, and I read it. He showed it to me, and I read the whole thing. It looked like a valid bulletin in a valid bulletin format from the church, and he had a copy of it. So I believe it, that it came out of the church and that it was a real issue. I don't know what's on OT8 specifically, and so I can't speak intelligently about whether it was or wasn't ever on OT8, but I believe it was. I don't have any reason not to. And I can see the controversy. It's a pretty wild issue. And I can see why they took it off. So that's my take on that.
Gentastic 823. In your opinion, to what extent did LRH believe his own con? Did he start a religion for the sole purpose of getting rich and wielding undue power over the minds of others? Over time, do you think that being constantly surrounded by people who essentially deified him, he fell under his own spell? I get the sense that the struggle in his mind between awareness of the true nature of Scientology and his desire to believe in his own greatness may have been the primary catalyst in his going completely insane in his later years. I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts. It seems pretty clear that David Miscavige is fully aware that he is selling a lie and does not regard Scientology's texts, practices, or beliefs as sacred. Yet in his youth, he was said to have been so devoted a believer that he became protege of LRH. Do you suppose his personal experiences and interactions with the man behind the curtain were the cause of his loss of faith in Scientology and his somewhat covert hostility toward its followers? Please keep up the amazing work. Thanks. Stuck in an electronic incident with Thetanists.
Well, okay, so, you know, this question comes up all the time. Did Hubbard believe his own BS, and does Miscavige believe it, and, you know, what, or do they know it's all a con and they're just hoodwinking everybody? You know, here's kind of a summary answer on this thing. Scientology makes people crazy. So, you know, I don't know if Hubbard was or wasn't crazy when he first started Scientology. It's a totally subjective question, and there's no way for me to know. What I think is that I think he started a con. I think he knew he was starting a con, but I think that he was a pretty sick guy, and he thought that he might also find the answer to his own, you know, mental and spiritual and physical problems, and then, you know, the answers that he was going to find were going to be the answers for everybody, and, you know, he kind of was narcissistic that way. And then over the years, I think he just went nuts. And I think he passed a point of no return in the mid-60s. And I think that, you know, he went downhill from there into incredible paranoid delusions and you know, all the rest. So Miscavige was basically raised in Scientology. And I think he was a pretty troubled kid. I think he had some real serious problems. And I do believe he is a sociopath, as in textbook sociopath. And I think that's something a person can be born with or born into. And he followed Hubbard's example, and he was around Hubbard, directly under Hubbard, getting Hubbard's directions for years. So I think he became a little Hubbard and then added his own sick twists to the whole thing. And he didn't develop Scientology. He didn't develop any part of Scientology, and I don't think he believes in it. And the reason I think that is because there's no evidence to convince me that he does. Doesn't go in session, doesn't do the tech. And I think he knows that it's something that doesn't work, doesn't produce results, and he's just, using it to satisfy his megalomania. So that's what I think of those two guys. All right, we got through a lot of questions this week, and with that, we are at the end of this episode. I want to encourage you again to check out the Sensibly Speaking podcast. Very, very happy with those podcasts, and I actually would love for you guys to check it out and give some comments and feedback on that. And of course, don't hesitate to keep giving me your questions and your comments. I want to hear from you guys. I see everything, and so give them to me in the comment section below. And if you haven't subscribed to my channel, please do so. And of course, if you get any value out of what I'm doing here, then show me some support. I have a Patreon page, or you can use the links on my homepage. So thank you very much for watching, and I will see you next week.